Diana is, I mean, for us, a pathbreaker for the Guardian Book Club because, as some of you might know, I mean, almost always at the Guardian Book Club, we do novels. And in fact, there's only ever been one exception before you, which we did the book about grammar, the book about punctuation.
Oh, yes.
Eat, Shoots, and Leaves. Thank you very much as a Christmas special. But it's a kind of, it's a sign of this extraordinary, I think, splash that Diana's memoir has made despite, or perhaps, I don't know, I think slightly because of the manner in which you rather sort of, you muse upon the chanciness and the luckiness and almost the casualness of it of its being written at all. I have to be careful because one of the sections in Somewhere Towards the End actually Diana confesses to starting off doing these kind of events, literary festivals and things, with a great deal of trepidation. And then, unlike many authors who lots of authors affect not to like this sort of thing, another of these things, Diana confesses that actually she's come to relish them and be rather good at them. And you describe one at the Hay Festival where you seem to have to restrain yourself from actually kind of...
Hogging it,
yeah. Well, you hog away if you want. I just wanted to start off by asking, I suppose, about the writing of this and how it came to be written, because in one part of it, you actually give an account of your sort of oeuvre and how your books came to be written and how, again, you confess something that most professional authors don't confess, even if it's true often, which is that in the past you wrote books sort of for therapeutic purposes, I suppose. And you say about some of your earlier books even that a couple of these books, once they were written, you weren't that much interested in them because they'd sort of done their job. Is that right? I mean, was this therapeutic, writing this book?
No, this is quite different. My writing career is split into two. It started in the 60s with Instead of a Letter. And that book, in fact, was not written because I planned it or thought about it in advance or anything. It simply happened to me in a most extraordinary way. It was much the most strange experience of all my writing that I've ever had. I meant to write a short story about something quite different, and it turned into that book. And that was, in fact, a really totally therapeutic thing, which I hadn't realized. It was years after the sad thing that I was writing about. I thought I was completely over it all, but I had, sort of secretly at the bottom of me, there was always a sort of slight sense of failure. And after that book had been written, the failure had gone completely, absolutely wiped it out. So it was a therapeutic thing. And it was very surprising to me that it produced quite a shapely and a book that looked as though it had been planned, really, because it hadn't been. I mean, obviously the planning had gone on when one was asleep, probably. So then, after that, I wrote a couple more books, and they were both when some horrible thing had happened. And as a way of sizing up what it was and why it was so distressing, and trying to get to the bottom of it. And that, it seemed to me, was what caused me to write. I thought, well, I'm obviously someone who writes under that stimulus. And when horrible things stopped happening, writing stopped happening. Which was in a way rather nice, but on the other hand, I missed it because I had enjoyed doing it. But when I retired from publishing when I was 75 and didn't think I was going to begin to write anything. Why should one? One wasn't going to have any more love affairs, wasn't going to have nothing was going to go wrong. My writing career was over. People then started rather nagging me and saying, you know, you've been 50 years in publishing, very interesting, you ought to write about it. And I thought, oh, pooh, that's nonsense, really. But I then started remembering amusing things, remembering things that I liked thinking of. And I started sort of scribbling them down for myself, really, just quite a different motivation, doing it for fun, and bits and pieces. And I did a couple of portraits for myself. One of them was of Jean Rees and Ian Jack, who was at that time editing Granter and was in charge of it, said, someone said, show it to him, it might do for Granter. And he said it wouldn't, it was too long. But if it was going to be part of a book, he would like to see the book. And so I thought, I wonder. If I start, I dug it all out, all my little bits and pieces. And I thought, well, if I put them together, and if I filled in a gap here, and if I did a little bit more there, I suppose it could make a book. And it did, and it went well. And so that was lovely. And so that set me off thinking, well, I didn't have to be writing books for therapeutic reasons. I could write for fun because I was interested. And so the next one I did was remembering my childhood, which I loved doing. But then I did think I was finished. And I said to Ian, well, I've written my last book. And he said, I don't know about that. I would like to read a book by you about being old. I said, are you mad? Because when we were published, and I was a publisher a long time before, we had published, I think, two books in which old age and death was important, and neither of them was it possible to sell. They were both dead flops. Because booksellers said, who wants to read these? It's morbid, it's boring. Nobody wants to buy books about old age and death. And so I had taken that as a sort of rule of thumb, you know, as a publisher. And if this book of mine had come to me, I wouldn't have published it. Because I was thought nobody's going to want to read it. And Ian, who was more sort of with his ear to the ground and knew much better than me that, in fact, the taboo had now ceased to exist. Because so many people now think to themselves, I'm going to have to live a good many years as an old person, and they get interested in the subject, and they want to think about it. And this book, without any question, has sold far more copies than anything I've ever written before. It's quite extraordinary, really. So that's why I wrote it. He said that, and I thought, no, mad. But it was as though a seed had been dropped in my head.
Well, he's a canny old thing then, isn't he?
I began to think then, just when, of course, one could say something about this, or one could say something about that. And there is something quite interesting about my mother having had such a lucky death. And, you know, bits and pieces came together. And the book does show this, really, because it almost is like a little series of essays on different aspects. It isn't sort of starting at the beginning and going to the end, really. But I wished I'd been able to think of more, really, because I enjoyed writing it in the end.
Well, it's modest of you to say, or self-deprecating in a way, to say that it's been appealing to people because of a sort of zeitgeist change that now do you think that's why? What? Being old age is now more of a, do you think it's like you say quite early in the book, and it really, it sort of rings true to me that once upon a time, if people were sort of over the age of 60, they had to wear sort of special dowdy clothes they weren't allowed to wear makeup, and they had to sort of behave and dress in a specially sort of
well, you see, that has changed.
Old way.
That has changed tremendously. And I think that things go in waves. I think that my mother wouldn't go to a funeral, would have died rather than let a child go to a funeral. And she was reacting violently against the sort of relish in death that Victorians took. You know, people have children being taken up to see their grannies lying dead in bed, which she thought was disgusting and awful. And I think her generation went against the Victorian relish for that last scenes and last words and death. And she was sort of anti-death. They'd been rather for death. And now I think it's gone over the hump and we're again facing death more easily.
I think it's your book a bit as well. I mean, I'm allowed as a reader to say that it's not just, but it may be a sort of social change, but also, I mean, you were talking about writing in the past, your first books about horrible things. And I'm sure you must know, as somebody with an interest in publishing and a career in publishing behind you, if you go into a large bookshop now and you go into the memoirs section, a lot of those are what?
The misery ones.
And actually, the paradox is that most of those books are books about being young. In Waterstone's main branch today, in Gower Street, there is a big table in the memoirs section, and it's called Childhood. And rather like you, I remember my childhood. There's some bleak bits in it, but generally speaking, it was kind of rather amusing and often comical and sort of quite happy. But all these books, many of them are famous. Some of them are very well written and deservedly famous, but they're almost all about terrible. Yes.
I sometimes feel really quite sheepish about having to admit that I enjoyed my childhood. I liked my family. And I think perhaps one was very lucky, unusually lucky, perhaps.
But I think this book, too, I think part of the appeal of it is that not that just that people are interested in old age and thinking about death, but actually that it's quite salutary in its lack of kind of grimness.
I think that the fact that I have been very, very lucky in keeping my marbles, which after all a lot of people don't do, and starting an interesting thing to do after I'd retired, and not many people. I'm quite proud of the fact that since I was 80, I published written and published three books, which is something that is quite not a common thing to happen. And I think it sort of cheers people up to think that this can happen, that people can have, when they're old, quite interesting times.
And you've sort of, I asked you at the beginning whether it was right to call it a memoir. I mean, it is quite, you won the Costa Biography Award with it, but it's quite unusual. Even perhaps your next best-known book, Stet, has a sort of chronological narrative. But somewhere towards the end, you have a very sort of, I think it's very cleverly done, although it's because it seems very artless. It's as if each section has a sort of theme almost, and that leads you usually into a particular recollection. But is that how you... I mean, did you plan it, or did that just happen?
No, that just happened, really. And it happened the other way around. Not that I had a theme and then brought in... It's just that I would remember a person or a happening, and that would bring in the theme.
Right.
It was... towards the end, I mean, I did think to myself, oh, well, now gardening. And because I was beginning to wonder what to write about at that stage. But then I thought about what are one's interests, and what are my interests in my old age, and there were the art class, the gardening, I'm mad about my old car driving about, and you know, these were things that I'd like doing. Those I did sort of tuck, count off on my fingers and think, well, I could write about that and that and that and that. But before that, it had been more as memories came to me. Mm. I enlarged on them.
Because that's how I remember before I read it, my wife grabbed it off me and read it, then I was reading it. And for the reader, that's how you recall it, not as a sort of chronology, but as she would say to me, have you got to the car section? the car section, that's a good one. And I think she was the one who suggested, which I borrowed for one of my gardening articles, that the hardest confession of all to make is guilt at a bit of bad driving. And that was, she said, that was when she knew that this was an honest book, because nobody ever usually confesses to being to incompetent driving. I wondered also about the, you lived a life amongst authors. The authors in... it happens a bit in Step, but in somewhere towards the end, emerge as quite a sort of, perhaps likeable sometimes and sometimes not, but rather foolish lot. Is that unfair?
That's unfair.
Yes.
Because I wouldn't say foolish. Some of them were foolish, some of them were...
I suppose in their dispensing of sort of wisdom to us about the kind of things you're writing about age and death and things. Whenever you quote an author, it's you sometimes exclaim, actually, Elias Canetti.
Oh, Elias Canetti.
Prods you to exasperation.
Well, I mean, he was a dreadful old man as a man. He may have been a great writer. I don't like his writing myself. But I think he was nonsensical about the question of death. I mean, to sit there saying, I refuse death, I don't accept death. And I said to his girl, his lover, did he really actually mean it? She said, oh, yes. And he wasn't going to die. He'd made up his mind that he was going to not die. That was foolish.
And Henry James, you quote towards the end, also sort of yes. One of these famous last words.
Well,
people.
I don't know even whether, is it anachronistic or did he really say that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of famous and famously just sort of debated about whether, you know, at last the distinguished thing. Was that what
this
he was
saying? Distinguished thing, yes. Yes. It seemed to me to be quite a strange.
Well, it's very characteristic of you to say what Henry James was thinking of when he called death distinguished, when it's the commonest thing in life, I can't imagine. Though the poor old man was at his last gasp when he said it, so one ought not to carp.
But if he was at his last gasp, one wouldn't carp.
No.
I don't know whether he really was or not.
I mean, it's sort of... I'm sure everybody here who's read the book will recognise that sort of... like lots of things you say it into brackets. You're a great sort of... There's lots of artful use of parentheses in the book. I wonder how self-conscious you are about something I sort of tried in one of the things I wrote about your book to kind of characterise, not very successfully, which is the style in which you write. Because I know that you will hear and read people often saying about, I think this latest book in particular, more than any of your others, that there's something, you know, you can almost hear the author talking to you. I think that's one thing people really like about it. I mean, is that just something that's instinctual, or do you find yourself thinking, oh, that's a rather idiomatic phrase, I shouldn't... Oh, no, I will use that. That's what I would say. That's what I'll write.
I hate thinking or talking about how I write because it's very dangerous. It can make you self-conscious. It can make you, if you aren't careful, you can start sort of doing yourself. I did it I was conscious, not in the book, but in the little piece I had to write to the about writing in The Guardian, which I had to do in a hurry.
And Don't say that.
Because I forgot about it. And I had to rather quickly do this little piece, and I ended it up. I suddenly realised, after uck, uck, yuck, I did a sort of little rather cute, sort of athily clutch at the end. And I thought, well, that's awful, because I did it consciously, trying to be like me. And normally I don't try to be like me. I just try to keep my mind on what I'm writing about. Mm. And that is a very important thing to me. I rather think about what I'm writing about than how I am writing.
But I suppose
occasionally I thought to myself, no, that's getting a bit too slangy, and I've cut it out. But it's not deliberate. It wasn't deliberate to begin with. I think it's on the whole, I'm glad that I write like that because it seems to work.
Yes.
But I'd rather not think about it.
Well, I'm sorry about that. Because, I mean, I suppose I asked partly because of your, you know, you spent your working life. I imagine being something of a sort of stickler for. I know that it was nice. You say how nice it was sometimes when you had authors that you didn't have to sort of correct things, but there were others that you had to rewrite the whole
book.
Well,
that would only be with someone who really couldn't write at all. But I think I was trying to... There were people who really couldn't. I mean, someone who'd written a book about a subject that was interesting, but who weren't writers, and who therefore... You know, the actual writing was a dog's dinner, but what they were saying was interesting. They would need sort of heavy editing, which was fun. I liked doing that. But my rules about writing, I was thinking about that at one point. There were three influences. And they are very simple-minded influences, but they're the three things that I think shaped the way I wrote. And the first thing was an old critic. He was called Sir Arthur Quiller Couch.
Oh, yes.
And he wrote about how one should write. This was when I was a child, I think I read this book. And what I took out of what he said was two things. If you can say something in two words, don't say it in six. If there's a choice between a complicated Latinate word and a nice simple Anglo-Saxon word, use the nice simple Anglo-Saxon word. Well, that stuck in my mind completely as a rule. And the funny thing is that many years afterwards, I went back and read some Quiller Couch. He was the most winsome writer. He had these two beautiful, good ideas. So that was one of my rules. And then my two other rules came, one from Jean Rhys and one from Vidyanaipaul. They both meant the same thing. Jean used to say, the important thing is to get it like it was, which means, you know, think about the thing you're writing about, not about anything else. And Vidya said, we were talking about right at the beginning, there was this problem of he wrote about a society and people quite unfamiliar to English people, their language and everything, and how difficult it was to... And people were a bit sort of cagey about being interested. And he said, but you know, if you actually get something right, it doesn't matter how unfamiliar it is, people will understand it. Saying the same thing as Jean was saying, really. And so those have been my things I've tried to do, always. Those are my rules. The rule is keep the writing simple and try and get it like it was.
But when you try and get it like it was, I mean, you're quite, I think, another reason why readers who are nowadays perhaps reading quite a lot of those memoirs on the groaning table at Waterstones take to this book is that a lot of the time memoirists seem to be able to, as it were, recall and get down things which, on reflection, they can't possibly have been able to recall and get down. I mean, lots of memoirs, for instance, have pages and pages of dialogue, as if you were reading Mansfield Park or something. But these are from, 50 years ago. And in fact, it must be some fictional reconstruction. But
there must be.
Yes.
Because dialogue is very... one thinks one remembers.
Yes.
I mean, I think I may have made people say things. I think I remember it. But you can't swear to it, ever. You couldn't have a long dialogue remembered.
Well, you seem to me to be very sort of self-disciplined, I suppose, about that. I mean, I couldn't remember reading this book anything where I thought, oh, how remarkable she could remember so much. And all the little phrases that you do quote seem almost sort of things which people might have said quite a few times, and therefore...
I think that anything that I quote, something that I really do think I remember.
Yes.
I hope I remember.
I like the Jean Rhys one. I was a bit drunk. Oh, very.
Well, a bit, well, very.
I think that's a very useful, it's an extremely useful one. It deserves to pass into
that. That was something that you often said. That was certainly a quote that I remembered.
I wonder if I could, I've been very, as you'll notice, I've been very sort of self-denying myself and not asked you about something the reviewers like to talk about quite a lot, which was the sex that's in the book, but it's not really in the book. I wonder if I could approach it indirectly, and ask you about, I don't know about the men in the book. This is something that interested me. And actually, I was thinking, perhaps this is an inapt comparison, but Lisa said something at the beginning about Doris Lessing, who came here and did the book club, and we talked about her book from 1962, I think it is, The Golden Notebook, which is also a book, I mean, it's obviously a work of fiction, but very autobiographical, and is about women who have, I suppose, sexually, apparently quite a liberated time, and all the men that they're having relationships with, well, almost all of them are married. That's the thing. And I got a kind of recollection of that slightly when I was reading your book. And you say quite early on in it, I don't think there was ever a time in my adult life when I didn't realise that men were quite likely to be technically unfaithful to women. And that seems, I'm not sure if you intended to give this impression, but the men in, you seem to me to be really very tolerant of the men in your book. I mean, perhaps you had to be in life, but I mean, they seem to me to sort of, you forgive them a great deal.
Well, I think one has to. You have a great deal to forgive. But also, I think that people do, this business of possessiveness, and it's again, this is really a matter of luck, because if you are born a naturally jealous person, you can't help it. I mean, people suffer tortures of the damned from being jealous, and they don't want to be jealous, but they are. If you're not jealous, you're very lucky. And I was not born particularly jealous. I've just been reading a proof of a book about Francis Partridge, who was involved with Lytton Strachey and all that lot. Incredibly, incredibly tolerant woman, but not just an understanding woman. What she put up with was unbelievable. But she said at one point, someone sided with her against Lytton and Carrington, who were trying to pinch Ralph Partridge, who wanted to marry her. And she was cross with them for siding with her. And she said, I really can't bear people who have this sort of geometrical approach to emotional relationships, all straight lines. They don't think of the sort of tender curvaceousness that rarely goes on in life. And there was plenty of tender curvaceousness going on in that set. And that she accepted it. She thought that's how life was. And it didn't upset her very much. And as a result, she and Rafe did, in fact, get together in spite of everything. They got married. They had a most happy, happy life together. Occasionally, he was unfaithful to her, but she didn't really mind because he loved her still, and she knew that. And she had a happier life than she would have had if she'd stickled for a faithful husband. And I think you do. Mm.
I suppose there were some bits where I was, let's say, where you were being, I thought, tolerant, where I found myself tempted to sort of read your account in a kind of different way or from a different point of view. I was thinking, for instance, when you talk about your a man who I think you were in love with, who you say, so it was a wartime fling, and how you admired him the more because even though if he'd said that he was going to leave his wife for you, you would have accepted that. But you sort of admired him for the fact that he wasn't going to. And am I getting
well,
this right?
True. No, I yeah, did.
And you say she was his good and blameless wife who had just become the mother of their first child. So leaving her would prove him cruel and irresponsible, which I was sure he was not. I would not have loved him so much if he had been.
But I did feel like that about that.
Oh, yeah, no, it reads completely truthfully. But, I mean, as a reader, I was slightly tempted to... I then thought about him, and I sort of thought, how convenient for him.
Jolly convenient.
Not how virtuous, you know, he wouldn't be enough of a cad to leave his wife, but how convenient for him to be the kind of chap who's not going to leave his wife.
Yes.
And so, I mean, that's what I mean, I suppose, when I said that quite often in the book you seem to me to be quite tolerant of behaviour of men, which particular readers who enjoy your account might judge more harshly. I don't know.
I suppose so. I think I'm sure, I mean, some people do judge much more harshly. And some people feel they have good cause to. I had a very, very furious, miserable letter from one woman on that exact thing, saying, you know, how could you have done that?
You say a bit further on that You sort of take it, I don't know, as a matter, as a sort of national mores. Vive la France, you say. So do you think this is a peculiarly, it is a peculiarly, the harsh judgment is a sort of English habit?
No, I think, I don't know. It's not, I mean, I would make a comparison there between the Hindu, the Muslim and the French. No, I don't think so. I suppose that the French are more realistic, or basically, than the English are in these matters, or they're supposed to be. And for that matter, what I quote at considerable length is from, now his name escapes me, the novel, the story that I quote. The people, the story. Of
the Singer story. Isaac Bashevis Singer, yeah.
Isaac Bashevis Singer, who is making the same point.
That sort of ignorance is bliss.
That ignorance can be, yes. Not only bliss, ignorance can save the situation. No harm done.
But I suppose perhaps people like to believe that relationships involve sort of total knowledge of another person.
I think they do like to believe it. I don't know that it's ever possible, really.
And do you think it's do you think that the picture that you give in somewhere towards the end is of a, I don't know, of a special kind of milieu that you might have lived in the 1950s and 1960s. I know there's a bit in Stett where you talk about the 1960s, and you say, you can hear, I think the reader can hear your voice. Most of the people I knew, you say a sexual revolution, most of the people I knew had been bedding each other for years without calling it a sexual revolution.
Well, Jean Rhys used to say that. She says, all such nonsense. When I came to London in 1914, everybody was going to bed with everybody, and everyone was using drugs. She was moving in rather loose circles, admittedly.
So I was thinking, on Chesil Beach wouldn't have been possible if...
On Chesil Beach really surprised me, actually.
Yes. It surprised you why? You thought it was an unrealistic picture of people in...
It didn't seem to me that there were so many people like that left. Yes. I was... It did seem to be a bit surprising.
Maybe I'm sure it's past time when I should give your readers a chance to either swap their experiences or ask any questions. So if anyone here, there's a lady straight away I'd like to ask.
I was very much the girl in On Chesil Beach. You're wrong when you say that people weren't as ignorant in those days as, because they were, lots of us were. But, I love this book so much, and I think one of the things I want to say is that it kind of inspires and motivates me to try and tidy up my diaries and my archives to try and produce something as perfect as you've written, not to be published, but for my family and grandchildren. It's lovely. But there is a question in this, and there are two. Did you keep diaries?
No,
that you're referring
never.
To? No. And
I'm
what are you writing now?
I've never done before.
Oh, so what are you writing now?
Can't think of anything to write at the moment. And so what I am doing, because I like the act of writing, I am sort of keeping a diary. I think it probably won't amount to anything, but I'm trying.
Can I ask you how you got on with your editor?
I've never had any problems with my editors, because they haven't really needed much editing. But I did get a little bit of editing from Ian Jack, who was one of the best editors I've ever come across, because he didn't fiddle about with details. But if he had a, he would say something like, I think that twice that he sort of suggested something, I would like a bit more about this, and then he'd leave it to you. And with Stett, he said, I do think you've got to somehow provide an end to it, which more or less ties up a bit more with the beginning. And I thought, oh, God. Then I thought about it, and I slept on it, and I thought, yes, he's perfectly right. And so I did. But that sort of editing, you know, that sort of someone who is interested in what you're writing and makes a comment on it like that, I love. But I don't need line by line editing, because I've done so much of it myself.
You also you do that thing that few writers nowadays do, which is you write quite short books.
I do. I write too short, I think. I'd love to write longer books.
This may seem a strange question, but looking back on your life and all the people you've known who are dead, do you think realists survive better, longer than romantics? I say this because of all the elderly people I know seem to have a very realistic approach to life.
Well, I'm not a romantic myself. But whether that explains why I've survived, I don't know. I really don't know. I think that probably, if you're not romantic, you don't suffer the disappointments that perhaps very romantic people do. They must have a rather hard time sometimes if they've got tremendously idealistic and romantic approach towards life. And that may wear them out. But I wouldn't know, really.
I really enjoyed the book, so thank you for that. Although I was quite anxious reading it, because you mention in a number of places, you know, worries about money. So I'm glad to hear that this book has sold well. And I hope, you know, your anxiety about not being able to afford sort of good care, should that be necessary. But anyway, I'm just wondering, I mean, are you as cheerful as you appear in the book and you appear to us tonight? Or is there some sense in which you feel responsible that you've got to present a sort of cheerful view of life to the rest of us who are coming up behind you?
Yeah, you know, there's an article in The Guardian not long ago saying that somebody has identified a gene for cheerfulness, optimism and cheerfulness. And I thought, that's it. That's what I was being lucky enough to have got. Because it isn't that I don't know how awful or frightening life is, because I mean, I'm quite prepared to believe that the world is soon going to be spinning round like Mars. We've ruined it forever. And it's not a happy view at all, but I can't help not actually thinking about it very much and thinking about the nice things that happen. And I think there is a gene or some genes which are for optimism, and I've got one.
They had a great word for it in the 18th century for precisely this quality. They called it elasticity.
Elasticity, yes.
Are you aware of times when you might have edited what you're writing, not for reasons of, not for literary reasons, but to avoid treading on other people's toes or embarrassing?
Yes, one does that a bit.
Yeah.
And one of the in my first book, for instance, I found that a difficulty, because instead of a letter, it sort of had to be all about me, because if I wrote about my friends in the same tone of voice as I was writing about me, I would offend them in no time. Because, I mean, you can say things about yourself, which if you know you're going to survive. But I had to leave out of my friends a lot of that first book, simply because of that. But now I'm a bit careful about family, but such as it is, let's live.
Were there any particular bits in somewhere towards the end where you felt, where you were aware of that it was,
no,
for you,
I do,
it felt
I do
tender?
I know, actually, dear things. I know two in my family who don't really like it very much, but they've been so sweet and kind about it that they would sooner that one didn't write that kind of book. But on the other hand, they're very tickled that other people like it. And they're greatly cheered up by the fact that I've got an OBE. They feel that I must be all right, really.
Well, you know that something else you've got in common with Kate Grenville, actually, is that when she came to the, like you, when she came to the Guardian Book Club, she was fresh from Buckingham Palace.
Yes, well, you see, it cheers people.
Yes.
It cheers up the people who think you're rather disreputable. They sort of feel better about you.
Diana will sign some books, yes, will you, if people would like their book signed?
I would, yes.
Yes. Before she does that, I'd just like to thank her so much for coming here and answering our questions, impertinent or not. And it's been great to have her. Thanks very much.